KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, we're talking about San Diego's dance community and a couple of plays bringing culture to the stage. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. Funding cuts are challenging dance theaters across San Diego.
We don't have a script to read or a score to play. We need to be in community together in a space to really create what we're doing.
Then John Leguizamo's show, Latin History for Morons, is back on stage at the Brooks Theater, while Jaja's African Hair Braiding is on stage at the La Jolla Playhouse. We'll hear from the director and playwright for both of those. That's ahead on Midday Edition. Many local dance organizations are feeling the pressure from funding cuts and other challenges to the arts landscape. Well, earlier this week, I spoke with two leaders in the local dance community who are navigating these challenges. Matt Carney is the executive director at the San Diego Ballet, and Zakia Mailer Salinas is the founder of Disco Riot, which is a nonprofit dance organization. I began by asking them what they lost as an organization since these cuts started happening.
So for Disco Riot, we've definitely seen some impacts from the NEA. At the federal level, we had a proposal in for our space residency project that we do annually that now just has sort of disappeared. At the state level, we've seen some changes in funding that support our Queer Movement Fest project that we also operate annually. And most recently at the state level, also some of the impact from the looking through the arts funding cuts to the payroll equity fund that we also submitted an application for earlier this year. So both federal and state changes. And then I think most recently, some of the changes in funding at the local level with the libraries and Park and Rec, as we also run programs out of library spaces and through Park and Rec, that are public-facing programs. So I think all across the board, we're definitely seeing these cuts as having some impact on our programming and having to reshape programming due to the loss of funds.
And I know the impact has been slightly different over at the San Diego Ballet. Matt, what are you experiencing there?
The loss of funds is definitely what comes to the top of my mind with that question. We see it from the different levels as well. On the federal level, we were awarded a National Endowment for the Arts grant, got the award letter, the whole nine yards, to fund programming in this calendar year, January to December. So we started the program and spent funds towards it. We got an email in about 2 weeks ago on a Friday at 6:30 p.m. saying that the grant had been revoked. So that was in the middle of the programmatic year we already started. So we had to commit that and keep going towards that project, even though the funds have been pulled back. On the state level, we've been advocating for a loss there from a systemic level of about $5 million. So we've been advocating to go to get $5 million back into the state California Arts Council budget that would bring us back to where we were 2 years ago. So we're still waiting to hear from the budget, but we're seeing kind of a systemic loss on the state level. On the county in San Diego, we're really trying to fight to find, they have a commission for arts and culture on the county level, but it's not yet funded. So we're trying to advocate to get that funded. And then we're seeing here on the city level, the Office of Cultural Affairs for the City of San Diego is getting a 10% cut. And we're all feeling the effects. And then to mirror some of the statements that Zakiya had mentioned, it goes further in terms of the cuts to libraries and parks, where That's not necessarily direct arts funding, but it is affecting us because we also do programs in those areas. In terms of the other loss, it's the loss of funds is obvious, but there's almost a loss of confidence and an increase of fear of how we can sustain moving forward. So it's kind of dealing with the brass tacks of the budget on the day-to-day basis, but also hesitant about the sustainability of our future.
And, you know, the San Diego Ballet, actually, you all just wrapped up your season with Romeo et Juliet. How are you looking back on this season and the challenges you've had to navigate so far?
We've been trying to present as much material as possible. We want to be able to give San Diegans an opportunity to step away from any stress and go into a theater setting and enjoy a show. So we're committed to doing programming. We're seeing increased expenses and about level on our ticket sales. So we're having to balance that. I think that the paradigm and system of big shows in the theater will be hard for us to maintain. And so we're looking to our left and our right, to our other nonprofit organizations, other arts organizations, and see if we can work together to increase partnerships and collaborations moving forward.
You know, both of your organizations offer so much to the San Diego community. Can you talk a bit about that, the importance of dance as an art? Zakiya, I'll start with you on that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I think first and foremost, what I would like to say about what we are up to specifically at Disco Riot is really looking at our independent local artists, independent local dance makers, performers, folks who are coming out of formal training programs, looking to build their careers, folks who are new to town, trying to figure out how to build and sustain community in San Diego, folks who are looking to make dances, research projects, develop teaching practices, and trying to resource those folks first and foremost, because we understand that while there are some dance companies in town, there are far more dancers and dance artists and movement artists in our community than are represented by those individual dance company organizations who also need access to resources so they can make work and so they can develop their practice. And what we've found through doing that over the last 6 or so years is that the role of artists in the community and also the role of community in supporting artists in San Diego is really lacking development. Not that the artists are lacking development, but that the sense of community around supporting artists is lacking development in San Diego. And so much of what we have been up to really centers on trying to cultivate that sense of community, because we understand that artists need community support as much as they need any of these other resources, whether it's studio space or production support or funds to make their work. Being in community is what makes this work sustainable beyond just those kind of concrete resources. We really need each other as resource. And what we are finding is that in engaging with dance in that way and building programming like our Queer Movement Fest, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks, that it's opening up dialogue with the larger community about how the larger community can support dance and support local artists. And we're really proud to be doing that work, but it's important work, especially right now, even more than it has been in the past. We really need that community engagement, not just around the financial resources, but like Matt was speaking to, people coming to see performances, people coming to open rehearsals, people showing up to classes and really involving themselves in the arts as a part of the arts community so that arts feels like it is also a part of the larger community and not just some sort of isolated component of what happens in San Diego.
And Matt, what are your thoughts about how these cuts are impacting the entire dance community here?
I think Zakiya really spoke well in terms of framing the dance industry as a community. For us, dance is human resources, humans dancing, and square footage. We need a lot of space. We don't have a script to read or a score to play. We need to be in community together in a space to really create what we're doing. And I think for us, we're maintaining employees, about 40 employees throughout the year that we want to be able to live and work in San Diego. It's important that we provide a living wage for people to be in the city and provide what they do in terms of catharsis in dance. You know, it's a non-verbal art form for the most part. There's something transcendental, that something that comes out when an audience member sees dance, that they feel it in a kinesthetic way, that the impact of this art form is so profound and needed now more than ever. And when we're going to really think about preserving concert dance is what I would say kind of an area of dance that we're working to preserve, where that audience member can really go in to the theater, the lights go dark, the stage lights come on, the curtain opens, and they're able to have that experience to get them away from their lives, or also help them process some of the things they're experiencing in a nonverbal way.
You know, what have conversations with other leaders in the dance world been like? I mean, how are you all working together to build community and to fill in the gaps?
I think we really work together. I mean, the reality is that we have our micro communities that we're dealing with our different companies or organizations. And we've been really tasked right now to solve problems we weren't anticipating. So, for example, think about the cut with the NEA. We had 7 days to make an appeal. Now, they sent that email out on Friday. You get the email on Monday. Mm-hmm. And now we have 4 days to make the appeal. So that week, we were kind of in survival mode of just dealing with the problem, dealing with putting out the fires. And I think that's where we are in reality sometimes at right now, based on everything that's being thrown at us, that looking to support each other is something that I think is going to be really part of the problem. We're not going to get that governmental support. We're seeing foundations shifting their priorities. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the philanthropy sector to help us right now. And as we emerge out of the survival mode and emerge out of handling these issues and solving these problems, we will be working together with different dance organizations, different dance artists, knowing that we will be the solution in working together to make this sustainable going forward.
Mm. Any final thoughts on that, Matt?
Yeah, I think that there's, a good... It comes to that we will be coming together to do this no matter what, no matter the funding and the culture. I mean, it's when we, as dance artists, and particularly in the contemporary dance field that, you know, is rooted in social activism and very much in America affected by the African diaspora, that by training our bodies to be in space, lets others know that we are in control of our bodies, no one else, the government or anyone else, so that no matter the funding or things that are happening on these systemic levels, the individual artist, you know, I run an organization, but it's made of individual artists. We are a dance company. The dancer is front and center. These human beings are the center of our art form, and we will continue to work together to produce and create work.
I've been speaking with Matt Carney, Executive Director at San Diego Ballet, and Zakiya Mailer-Salinas, founder of Disco Riot. Matt, Zakiya, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jade.
Thank you.
Coming up on Midday Edition, Oceanside Theater Company wants to enroll you in Latin history for morons.
You know, there's two sides of history, and our history is just not recorded in our textbooks. And so this play tries to right a wrong.
More about that play when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. How do you recap 3,000 years of Latin history in under 2 hours? Well, Oceanside Theater Company's latest show, Latin History for Morons, does just that with a comedic flair. It was originally a one-man show performed by actor John Leguizamo, inspired by the absence of Latinos in U.S. history textbooks. We actually interviewed Leguizamo in 2016 when he first brought the show to the La Jolla Playhouse.
This is a bigger thing. It's not such a marginalized bit of history. I mean, these were really important people who participated in contributing to the founding of democracy in this country. And to strike them out of not being present in history books, we're doing ourselves a disservice.
KPBS arts reporter Beth Accomando sat down with director Herbert Seguenza about bringing that history back to the stage. Here's that conversation.
Herbert, you are going to be directing Latin History for Morons at the Oceanside Theater Company. Tell us a little bit about this play.
Well, this play is very interesting. John Leguizamo wrote it back, I think he started in 2016. So a lot has changed. Latin history, well, you know, world history has changed a lot since 2019, as we know. But when he wrote it, he basically wanted to educate people about Latino contributions to the world and to the United States, because I guess he was doing research for his son, I think, had a project like that to talk about Latino heroes, and they just couldn't find any in the U.S. history books. And it's so true. I mean, if you go through our U.S. history books, you find very little about Latino contributions. You hear about the Mexican-American War, but you really don't know why, you know, the motivation to the, you know, of the Mexican-American War. There's, you know, there's two sides of history, and our history is just not recorded in our textbooks. And so this play tries to right a wrong. So I'm really excited about it. And as you know, Latinos in general, the community is being viciously attacked by our administration. And so I think it's just really important to talk about our contributions as not just as Latinos, but as Americans. And I think we have to remind people that we are American. We have 4 or 5 generations now since the Treaty of Guadalupe defined the border. There was people on this side of the border that were already here. And so they are American, and they've been American for many generations. And so it's just good to we have to repeat that, because I think the mainstream sees us as foreigners, which is the case. But in many instances, we're not foreigners. We are American as enchilada pie.
Now, this was written in 2016, which was under the first Trump administration. We're now in the second Trump administration. Has there been anything added or changed, or is it kind of sadly still as relevant as it was then?
The play is more relevant because I think we got permission from John Leguizamo to kind of update it, because we had to update it because things have changed considerably. The attacks are just more vicious, more direct. And I think we, as artists, we have to respond to that. You know, John Leguizamo is a particular performer with a particular energy. And Rick Nájera, my performer, is not John Leguizamo. And so let us tweak it a little to fit our physicality, our vicinity to the Mexican border, and all these things. And so we have tweaked it here and there to just make it a lot more relevant and a lot more localized, too.
Well, and you have a long history with Culture Clash as a founding member in terms of using theater, using comedy. So talk a little bit about like what you're bringing to this play from that and what you've learned over these decades of, you know, trying to use humor and satire to affect change.
Well, yeah, John Leguizamo's career and Culture Clash's career parallel each other a lot. We both came out in the 90s around the same time, late 80s, 90s, and we came up. And yeah, he was doing comedy as a political way of getting a message across, just like Culture Clash. So when I saw this play, I was like, oh, this is right up my alley, you know? This is in my wheelhouse. So when they asked me to direct it, I said yes, because it's in my comfort zone for sure. It's a solo show where you need a real versatile actor to do voices, to sing, to dance, to do all these things that we're used to doing as Culture Clash. So this was right up my alley. And Rick Najera is a seasoned performer as well, comes from that school of thought. And so it was just a perfect marriage.
And this is going to be at the historic Brooks Theater. What is that like putting on a play there up in North County?
Yeah, the theater is beautiful. It's a really nice, nice community theater. I'm impressed with the energy that Alex and Kevin Burrows are bringing to the community. They're perfectly located right downtown in Oceanside. So I'm just really excited about their future there at the Brooks. I think this is their first Latino play. And so, you know, we want this to be successful because we want, you know, I personally want to see a Latino play there every year, right? So this is the first one, and we hope people come out and see it.
What can you tell people to expect from this? I mean, you are getting a history lesson, but you're also getting entertained. So what kind of expectations should people bring to this?
This is entertainment, first of all. John Leguizamo is an entertainer. The history is not like 100% accurate. You know, he takes his liberties for entertainment's sake. But overall, it just explains how important we had empires here in the Americas. The colonization by Spain just was devastating for the natives who were living here peacefully in the 1500s. And so we want to really show how that conquest, that colonization 500 years ago, is still, in a sense, with us today, if not in our DNA. And I think it's really important for people to know that we're still recovering from 500 years of colonization. I know that doesn't sound funny, but it's not. It's not funny, but it is psychological. It's in our DNA. I think we all live with it unconsciously. And I think that's what it's about. You know, it's a real personal journey about being Latino in the United States, being Latino in the Americas. And I think we want to emphasize that this is a continent. You know, people call the United States America. Well, that's not right. America is North and South America. It's the continent of America. And I think we have to look at it as a holistic continent instead of, you know, the United States as the de facto, you know, as the status quo of America. It isn't. There's a whole other continent, millions of people and histories that are important as well.
I've seen some interviews with John Leguizamo when he was doing research for this play. And I'm curious, was there any history or information in the play that felt new to you or that was a discovery for you?
Not really. I'm a big history buff, too. I'm a big Latin history buff. So I knew a lot about, you know, there's certain names that he brings up in the play that, you know, I didn't know. But I overall knew that we had participated. I didn't know how much we participated in the Revolutionary War. And that's pretty interesting. That's really interesting. We were definitely present there. We apparently funded a lot of it, you know, through gold and through people's efforts. There was a general that donated a lot of arms to Washington to overthrow the British. So we're always getting in trouble.
Now, the play is called Latin History for Morons. And in the original version of the play, I'm not sure if this has changed, it's the audience who are the morons that are being educated. So will we as audience members come out of there being a little less moronic?
I think so. For sure, empathy, you know, I think theater is about empathy, right? And it's not just education, but it's like, oh, I see why. Now I know why there's so many Mexicans. You know, now I know why there's Salvadorans in California. It's because of this history, right? The empathy, the civil wars we've had, all this stuff, you know. So we just want to let people know that, you know, we're you know, people don't immigrate to the United States because they want to. They had to in many cases, right? Or they were stuck in the middle of this, the Mexican-American War. So history really informs the present. And I think we really have to look back in order to see where we're going.
All right. I want to thank you very much for talking about Latin History for Morons.
Thank you for having me.
That was Beth Accomando speaking with director Herbert Siguenza. Oceanside Theater Company's production of Latin History for Morons opens Friday at the Brooks Theater. Up next, Jaja's African Hair Braiding takes us to a bustling braiding shop in Harlem.
I always have a story every time I leave a hair braiding shop, even if it seems pretty, innocuous. Those little moments, I think, are part of the fabric of what I think makes the play, so unique.
Hear more about that play when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Jaja's African Hair Braiding by New York-based playwright Jocelyn Bio is the latest play at the La Jolla Playhouse. It opened on Broadway in 2023 and has since been nominated for 6 Tony Awards, winning 2. The story takes place in a West African hair braiding salon in Harlem, where a group of hair braiders and customers share their days, hopes, and dreams together. At the heart is Jaja and her daughter Marie. Now, Jaja is about to get married in what the women in the salon assume is a green card marriage. But as the play unfolds, we uncover what the American dream means to these women. KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans recently spoke with playwright Jocelyn Bio on the phone as she navigated her way through Harlem. Here's that conversation.
So I understand that since you were a little girl, you've been going to West African hair braiding shops. Can you take us inside and talk a little bit about what makes these salons so important to you?
They're important for a myriad of reasons. One, I mean, it was a kind of economic decision to get my hair braided. We didn't grow up with a lot of money, and I certainly didn't have a lot of time to worry about my hair. So going to get my hair braided in a style that could last for a couple of months was economically really smart for me and my family. And so these places kind of became like a second home to me because I was, there so often. I still am there so often. And I think they're important spaces because, I mean, look, most of the women who own these shops are West immigrant hair braiders themselves who have come to this country. They're entrepreneurs looking to start their own business, have something of their own. And I mean, for anybody, much less, the average American, that takes a lot of work, to start your own business and hope that it's successful, especially, in a city like New York. So I think these spaces are just also important for the communities, too. Oftentimes, a lot of the African hair braiding shops that exist are in, Black and brown communities, places that probably have families who are similar to mine, who need to have some sort of make an economic decision about their hair. And the vulnerability that also is involved with that as well. Going in there and trusting someone to do a style that will work, that you like, you develop these kind of relationships with these women as well. And so they're just really important spaces, not just for the commerce, but, I think for the community.
And in terms of like bringing that space to life on a stage, what is the environment like? How vibrant is it? How rowdy is it? How peaceful is it? Can you paint a little picture for us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say they're probably very noisy. I would not be able to take a call like this at a hair braiding shop for sure. There's so many people in there, lots of music playing. There may be even a movie sometimes going on the TV screen. The news might be on. And then, you know, there's a lot of these women are friends, you know, so you're thinking, I don't know, anywhere from 4 to 5. I've been in small shops where there's only like 4 or 5 hair braiders. I've been in bigger shops where there's like 20 or 25 hair braiders. And so what if there's an argument that happens between two braiders or a customer even? Or what if someone's telling a funny story that's making everybody in the shop laugh? It's a very vibrant, you know, space. And I always have a story. I always have a story every time I leave a hair braiding shop, even if it seems, you know, pretty, you know, innocuous. Those little moments, I think, are part of the fabric of what I think makes the play, you know, so unique and special and fun that I have 30 plus years of stories to share and was able to put into a play.
Can you tell us about the characters in Dja Dja's African Hair Braiding? There's Dja Dja and her daughter Marie, but also tell us about some of these other women that are in the space.
Well, there's so many women who kind of make up the tapestry, the quilt, if you will, of the shop. Yes, you mentioned Dja Dja, who's, you know, the eponymous owner of the shop. There's Marie, her, you know, teenage daughter, who for all intents and purposes, it comes off as like the average American teenager who's just, you know, looking for her place in the world and, you know, wants a bright future for herself, but is not really sure how to get it. Mm-hmm. We also have Bea, who is kind of the curmudgeon of the group, I would say. She's the one who's kind of been at the shop the longest and maybe has the most history with Dja Dja that kind of predates even opening the shop. They were both struggling immigrants together. And so she's got a bit of a chip on her shoulder about perhaps how Dja Dja was able to move up in the world and in a way that Bea couldn't.
Talk a little more about the connections and the friendships between these women. Like, what's significant about the way that they can connect and interact and like be around each other hour after hour in these shops?
I mean, I don't know that it's more significant than any average, you know, workplace. I mean, what constitutes any of us to be in an office or a school or you know, a hospital, any place where you're kind of working in community with a bunch of people for hours and hours and hours on end. You know, some people you like, some people you don't. Some people become your best friends. Some people you know, hope they quit and you never see them again. I mean, it's all of those things. I just think I'm putting, you know, there's a universality to the workplace that we all kind of know and share and understand. I think I'm just putting those relationships, those ideas, those people in a setting that we've never really seen before, and that maybe, you know, unless you've, you know, lived in New York or lived in Harlem or frequent hair braiding shops as much as I do, you know, you think it may be different in there. It may not feel the same. And I think a lot of times audiences walk out feeling a real like kinship with the women, with the shop, and a kind of universality about what an intimate workplace setting is like.
So Dja Dja is about to get married, right? In order to secure a green card. What is at stake for her? And how does that kind of like square away with her ideas of the American dream for Dja Dja and for the others?
Well, I mean, you know, one would argue that I think I pose a really interesting question in the play of whether Dja Dja's marriage to Steven is solely transactional just for a green card, or if there's actually really love there. And I think that's really important because, you know, as me being the child of immigrants myself, both my parents are from Ghana and West Africa, I have, you know, seen and heard and even attended, you know, weddings that had these same kind of question marks, you know, or seen unions that had these same question marks. But at the end of the day, I do feel like every immigrant who comes, by and large, every immigrant who comes to this country is in search of, you know, comeuppance, of a better life that they maybe feel like they can't quite have in wherever their, you know, country of origin is. And there's just a lot of red tape that America, becoming an American citizen at least, makes you really cut through. And I think I just wanted to present a more, I wanted to humanize the people behind the policy. I think oftentimes we just kind of paint immigration with such a singular narrative. And it's more complex than that. And I think showing Jaja's relationship, showing all of the women, you know, and you know, some of them sharing their stories of even how they, you know, got to this country and even became citizens. I'm just trying to highlight the complexities that exist within that. And, you know, hope that people have, if people walk in with some implicit biases about that, that maybe they shift a little bit when they leave.
You recently became a mother, and there is a mother-daughter story at the heart of this play with Jaja and Marie. Marie has just graduated high school. How has motherhood, even at this early stage, impacted how you see mother-daughter relationships in your creative work?
Oh, such a great question. I mean, I think I have a lot of I have a lot of feelings about mother-daughter relationships. I mean, I have a very unique relationship with my mom, who I think is just, you know, a very particular individual and a kind of person who I would, in some cases, say could be an acquired taste. She's kind of like a tough mom, you know. She doesn't always say the right thing or do the right thing to some people, and to others, it's just tough love, you know? And I feel like I'm always unpacking facets of my relationship with my mom in my work. And so I think I was able to put a lot of that into, you know, this play. I think becoming a mom, I mean, I became a mom so early in the process of writing of the play getting produced in the original production on Broadway. When I started rehearsals, my child was only 6 weeks old. So I think I was, you know, in some cases, just trying to make sure I was getting enough sleep. But in other ways, I kind of really understood in a visceral way sacrifice and, you know, caring and understanding and kind of like just putting everything to the side so that way everything with my kid came first, you know. And so I really, really understood Jaja's perspective on things. Like, you know, there's a world where maybe some of her actions and decisions could come off selfish, but, you know, ultimately she really is doing what she can to for the sake of her daughter and their future. And I don't think you have to be a mom to understand that, but I feel like I did in a different way when I became a mom.
How does humor play into this story? And how does humor exist in these spaces, in the salons, in these relationships between mothers and daughters?
At the end of the day, I do feel like there's a quote I read when I was in grad school that has kind of become my thesis statement, which is just comedy is just a funny way of being serious. And which, you know, I've really come to understand the older I've gotten and the more, you know, work I've written. It's really just about sharing a truth, but how you share that truth sometimes is really important. You know, to some people, they love a drama. They love being able to go somewhere and just cry, you know, and, you know, and express all of their, you know, emotions and feelings in that way. I feel like, you know, comedy and humor is important because of that spoonful of sugar mentality. I think you can really, you know, I think you can invite people to the, you know, the party, and the music may be different, like the vibe may be different, you know, even the way somebody's like getting the story could be different, but it really ends up being a very powerful tool to endear people to, especially to what I'm doing, endear people to characters that we don't always see. I mean, there's so much about Africa and African culture and African immigrants even that is not mainstream in any way. I think even a lot of times some people hear an African dialect and don't even realize that they're kind of trained for the story to inherently be sad. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, and I understand that because there's so much of the narrative of so many African countries that did struggle and did have, you know, post-colonial strife, whether it was war or disease or famine or anything like that. But that's not the truth of everybody on the continent. And I think using humor to tell African stories in a lot of ways feels, you know, radical, even though I just think the truly short answer is just that's naturally where my voice lives, just naturally where I go. And it's worked out so far.
That was Jocelyn Bio speaking with KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Her play, Jaja's African Hair Braiding, is on stage at the La Jolla Playhouse through June 15th. That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.